Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today, Wednesday, January 17th, 2011, it's Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And it's only fitting that we have a show really centered around the idea of service. In that regard, we have co-author of a new book called The Network Nonprofit, Beth Cantor, who will be joining us in a moment. Beth Cantor has been on our show before and is sort of a legend in the nonprofit world for helping bring many people and nonprofits together online and make the most of using social networking and other types of technology to help nonprofits reach their fundraising and other goals, helping them reach prominence and stature in this country and in others. She's the CEO of Zoteca, I believe is how you say it. It's a company that serves nonprofits, and it has that socially conscious concept in mind in the way that it works. She's been named by Fast Company as one of the most influential women in technology, and by Business Week's Voices in Innovation and Social Media as one of the also most influential women. And she is currently a visiting scholar for social media and nonprofits for the Packard Foundation, as well as a 2010 Society for New Communications Research Fellow. She curated the NTEN, We Are Media Nonprofit Social Media Starter Kit, which is an online community for people interested in learning and teaching about social media strategies and tools that enable nonprofit organizations to create, compile, distribute their stories, so basically archive their stories as well as give them a platform to, you know, thrive and build their reputation, which is so key in this area. So while we wait for her to call in, we can look over. There's a few questions from earlier when we had some crossed wires and we're trying to get the show off the ground, and people had asked some questions, and there are some sort of typical questions for many people in the nonprofit arena, many of whom are trying to find places to host, to basically host events, so corporate venues and that sort of thing. And I always encourage people to try to find, you know, nice spaces or go to their local, if they have one, social media club. There are often places that, you know, at least people can help direct you to find those places and those people who will lend out their conference room for an evening event, who often have to be there in person for the event, but who are able to stay there and be there and will kind of shepherd the event on, which is, it's so key to making anything really happen and is always really nice to see as well. So let's see if Beth is with us yet. Nope, not quite. So a couple of resources for folks in the nonprofit space that you may or may not be aware of, and it's always good to list them if you're not particularly aware of them. I always like to tell people about these resources. And they are, of course, the TechSoup Global organization. And they're just a fantastic group that, if you go to TechSoup.org, can certainly help you in terms of, getting you resources and getting you help, and are very lovely people. Let's see. I think we have Beth here with us. Beth, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, sorry about getting our wires crossed earlier. How are you?
All right. How are you?
Very good. Thank you. And no,
I got to listen to some rocking on hold music.
Well, I'm glad. Hopefully it got you in the right mood. And I had said earlier, I think it's only fitting in the spirit of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day that we be talking about service and nonprofits.
That's terrific.
Yeah, so I welcome you back to the show, and you're coming back, and you are coming back as the co-author of a new book called The Network Nonprofit. Tell us about that.
Great. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Of course.
And this time I'm now a San Francisco resident, so I'm in the Bay Area, which is also very exciting. I made a big move from the East Coast to the West Coast since the last time we spoke. And all
wow.
of that was as part of accepting a post as visiting scholar at the Lucille and David Packard Foundation, which very generously provided me time to do the writing. And I worked with co-author Allison Fine on this book. And I'm going to sort of we thought it was really important to, like, put a flag and stake this, you know, put a flag and stake it out for this point in time and really capture what was happening with nonprofits and the adoption of social media. Up until then, I think, you know, over the last year and a half, social media and nonprofits have been in the arena of early adopters. And when we looked out over the landscape, we saw a lot of nonprofits kind of stuck, either not adopting, highly skeptical, or just maybe not getting results. And so we wrote this book for nonprofit leaders who have been in their role for many, many decades and are just, you know, trying to grapple with, you know, what is this new way of working? What is this social media stuff? Is it just for kids? Is it a fad? You know, and
will it go away? Do I need to scale for this? Should I use my existing staff?
Yeah, how much time will it take, or, you know, and, you know, et cetera. So, so this was a book really geared at leaders to walk them through what, you know, what working in this new way really means. What's the reality of that, and how do we go through organizational transformation, when it's happening with younger people in our organization? How do we allow ourselves to be reverse mentored? How do we... you know, instead of blasting out our messages, how do we engage in conversation? It all feels very foreign to them. And so in a nutshell, the book is, I could just give you a tweet on it. It's nonprofit organizations need to work more like networks than isolated organizations. And so we define networked nonprofits as nonprofits that are simple, they're agile, they work in a very transparent way, they allow insiders to get out and outsiders to get in, and they're also experts at using social media and all aspects of running their program, whether it's communication strategy, program delivery, whether it's even the board that's using it for governance. And so, and in the research that we did in the field, we found that there were sort of two types of nonprofits. There were those that were born as network nonprofits. You know, they were already working in these very open and collaborative ways before there was a Facebook or before there was a Wikipedia. And so for them, it's very easy for them to adopt the tools and be effective. And then there were others, traditional nonprofits, that were in the process of transformation. And so the book really lays out a framework for those organizations to, you know, to slowly go through this transformation. It's not something that happens overnight, especially for larger institutions, because we're talking about change. We all know how what change is like at an individual level. I mean, this year I said I'm going to walk my kids to school every morning, I'm going to get exercise, I'm going to lose weight, I'm going to prepare for all my presentations in advance and actually practice them, you know. And just for me to make a change on a personal level, that's really hard. But when you're in an organization that's been around for a while and with lots of people, it's even harder. So, so it's probably too much information right there.
No, it's not. But I think what would be really good is to think about, I would love to hear if there was a kind of a common theme that seemed to come up in the different areas that you go into in terms of where we are today. Because, you know, the one thing that occurred to me as you were talking is that the nonprofits that I know of that have done such a wonderful work and where there are case studies, you know, that we can actually look to try to, you know, make a case and help people that we may know in the nonprofit world make the case to their board or their bosses to move ahead, to be able to make some inroads in in the social networking space, you know, you look to organizations that have had to make the change during times of conflict or pressure. So you look at the American Red Cross. You know, a flood happened or some other natural disaster, and it was actually a real-time, you know, they used Twitter or something else as a real-time method of communication. So I'm curious sort of if there's a theme for what an organization does that doesn't have that immediacy or that need to actually help people on this very real level, push them or thrust them into that organizational change. I assume it would be much more gradual for probably most other organizations.
It is, and also, you know, the Red Cross was one of the case studies we used. I've had the privilege of working with, alongside and observing, Wendy Harmon, who is their social media manager, and watching them grow over the last 5 or 6 years. So, you know, the Red Cross got started right after Katrina in 2005, mm-hmm. Where they realized they needed to work in a much more transparent way. They needed to respond to people, you know, in terms of their communication strategy, and because they knew that bloggers were saying mean things about them. So they mm-hmm. needed to sort of kind of engage in the social media realm. And in the beginning, it was very difficult because there was fear, there was concern. What if people say negative things about us? And how do we respond? And I know Wendy, her beginning practice was focused on listening. And listening in a way that encouraged organizational transformation. So she did, you know, all the kinds of things we do to listen in those days, which was about keyword searches, using Google Alerts. This was before Twitter. And really summarizing what the themes were and what the influence levels of the people that were saying them. And then she would share that internally. So, and what they discovered was, for example, the community outreach department discovered that this information was really, really valuable. It was like as valuable as focus groups, but it was free.
Mm.
Because at the time, and this is when, you know, blogs were the rage, people were blogging about their, you know, experience of donating blood to the Red Cross, even down to like whether the cookie was fresh or not. And so,
wow.
So that gave, you know, their communications area a lot of really good, valuable information. And so it was through this kind, and that was over a year of that. And sort of the next level up, I think about it when Twitter came out and the Red Cross was an early adopter and they were just responding to people, having conversations. And I remember, and Wendy describes it as they kind of scan and they see what people are saying. If it's something, a compliment, they'll respond to them and say thank you. If it's a customer complaint, they'll try to find out whether it's a real complaint or it is a perception of a complaint. And if it's something that they need to address, she will get that to the right person internally. I know at one point, I think 2008 or so, there were lots of complaints on Twitter about their database reminder system for people to give blood. It was broken and people were getting asked repeated times and people were actually complaining about this on Twitter. And so when he was able to, you know, compile that information and get started dialogue and actually with the database department and get some improvements made. And then, you know, because social media in a sense is an early warning system. And so if they found that there was an influencer who had a complaint, they could kick into high gear and avoid a disaster of a PR kind. And then also at this time, this was 2008, 2009, when bird flu came out. Remember that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was here in San Francisco. It was April of 2009, and I remember people were walking around with masks. And remember when people were saying, oh, don't eat bacon or you'll get – oh, swine flu. It was –
yeah,
it was swine flu. So they said, "Don't eat bacon, or you'll get swine flu." And so
the National Institutes of Health were then changed. That's how it got changed over to H1N1 vaccine because they didn't want to associate it with pigs and the pork industry.
Right, but at the time, Wendy and her team were monitoring this, and every time people were sort of saying, you know, passing along this incorrect rumor, they would point them over to the correct information. And also at that time, that's just when their affiliates were starting to get online. And I remember there's a page you can go up to, and you can see all the Twitter accounts of all the Red Cross affiliates, And it's on a blog, so it's a blog page with comments. And I remember, like, looking through the comments and seeing a comment from someone saying, how come my local Red Cross isn't here on Twitter? Should they be?
Ah.
Which was a big turning point.
Yeah, and I bet that, you know, one of the things that I had wondered was, you know, you coming out with a new book, you must get asked questions all the time. And I know even I spoke at an event last week on social media marketing, and somebody said, well, what about nonprofit organizations? And I know that I have my, you know, organizations that I always send people to, you know, if I get the general question. If I get more specific questions, I generally will send them over. Well, certainly you're a great resource because you've always Beth's blog. If you folks listening out there, if anybody is new to the nonprofit space and hasn't seen Beth's blog, you need to go see it. So I think what's the URL? Is it Beth.typepad?
No, you know what? I moved over to my own domain, so it's www.bethcantor.org, and I got a whole new blog design, and I moved to WordPress. I do keep the old one because, which is on Typepad, but that's just the attic resource. It's
yeah, that's your archive. Yeah, absolutely. So Bethcantor with a K.org. Fantastic resource, because one thing, Beth, that's been great is you do so much sharing through writing. I know a lot of people don't write as prolifically or as specifically as you do about the challenges that one might face or, you know, looking at solutions. So it's a great resource. TechSoup Global at TechSoup.org, I talk about. Taproot Foundation is another one. What are your favorites that you like to refer people to, and that you know, besides the book itself, does the book refer to sort of, you know, resources of, you know, you're kind of archiving a space and time. So I guess the larger question is, you know, where do nonprofits kind of go from here? Does it read like a playbook for them to kind of do the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in terms of evaluating how things should progress in their organization?
Yes, it does. Let me answer your question about resources, and I'll discipline myself not to be overwhelming.
Very hard not to fire hose, I know.
Right. So the book itself, we specifically it does not really focus in on how to use Facebook or how to use Twitter. It's not a tactical book because we really believe that strategy and organizational change, good process for that, is not going to change. It's not tool dependent. You know,
that's true.
Yeah, the tools
people dependent.
Come and go, but you know, change organizations and people stay the same, and so the change issues are the same. And strategy is strategy, no matter what tool you choose.
Mm-hmm.
So in the book, we end each chapter with a set of reflection questions and a set of resources that speak to each of those areas. So that's one. And I also, what's been really interesting to me is there's been virtual self-organized book clubs discussing the book. So So I put together a wiki of updated resources and also a kind of book club guide, and that's at networkednonprofit.wikispaces.com. So that, and of course, I'm blogging about these ideas still, you know, and capturing new stories and as I do other types of projects. So that's one area. A fantastic resource you already named is TechSoup Global, and I think that's like one of my stomping grounds, my watering hole. I visit them in the forums, their Facebook presence. I know I watch their Twitter feed. They do fantastic work. There's N10, which is www.n10.org, which is the Nonprofit Technologies Enterprise Network, which is the Association for Nonprofit Techies, and they have an annual conference. This year it's happening in March in D.C., and that's like Mecca for nonprofit techs. You know,
oh, it is. It's fantastic. They just had their Pioneer Awards. Is that the organization that had the Pioneer Awards? I'm trying to remember.
Maybe.
In the year.
It's been around for 10, 11 years, the conference,
yep.
And it is the best professional development experience. And I'm biased because I've been involved with them since the beginning. And one of the things that I do at every conference is organize a day of service. since we're all, you know, talking on a day of service. And this year is really exciting because we have a donation from Cisco for all the parts of a wireless network, and we're working. So a group of techies will go install this wireless network at a agency that serves transitional homeless. They'll also be doing a computer recycling program, and because they're housed in the same building as DC Central Soup Kitchen, there's also another group of volunteers who are going and preparing meals. And every year we've done something slightly different, but this year is the kind of real service activities. And my job is, my title now for this conference is Chief Storyteller, so I'll be documenting what the technologists are doing and sort of bring them in. But the The program itself is pretty amazing. It covers traditional IT, social media, communications, training, and leadership all around nonprofit technology. And there's probably about maybe close to 2,000 people that go every year, and it's just a fantastic networking networking thing. I also worked with them on a project called We Are Media, and it's www.wearemedia.org, and that was a wiki project where 200-plus nonprofit social media trainers co-created a curriculum for nonprofits and social media, plus built all of these resources. And then that was also used as curriculum for face-to-face workshops, for webinars, for e-learning sources. So it's a tremendous resource. It's still sort of kept up by the community. That's another place I still reference. And then I have my own wiki, BethCantor.wikispaces.com, and all of my training materials from, I have like way too many wikis, but I do probably 100 workshops a year. And speaking.
You're great.
Yeah, and each one there, I update, or it's a different community, so that's there. Long way to
fantastic.
Way to tons of
we'll
resources.
Let's see if we can get all these in a tweet out there.
You know, I forgot about the most important one, or the one that I'm
which
enjoying.
Is it?
Well, we decided on my Facebook page, which is facebook.com/beth.cantor.blog, we run something called the Zoetica Salon, which is my company's name, and where we have a monthly theme, and we ask and answer questions. Like, for example,
that's fantastic.
And it's been great because it's not just us answering the questions, the community's answering the questions, and there's like 8,000 people who are, I don't know, fans or whatever the word is. And it's just been a tremendous
like
resource.
Whatever they are.
The likes, I don't know. I think that's kind of weird. But, like, for example, today's post was my turn to post. So I found a quote from Martin Luther King. It says that, you know, if you can't run, walk. If you can't walk, crawl. But you need to be moving forward, you can't stay still. So my question was, where's your social media? Are you crawling, walking, and running, and what do you need to move forward? So we have lots of fun conversations.
Very good.
Plus, I always learn there because people are sharing stuff they're doing. And so I learn about new tools and new tips because there's a lot of, you know, really great techie sharers there as well. So...
Yeah, so one of the things that is always, well, not always a challenge, but can be a challenge is, you know, finding the right medium. So I know, you know, a lot of questions that I've gotten before the show is, and from people that I know in the space that are working tirelessly in nonprofits every day, are asking, you know, where should I be? Should I be on Facebook? Should I be on Twitter? And I think that, you know, an answer from someone like yourself would probably be really helpful to them just so that they understand kind of how to prioritize learning. So even if they're doing some sort of reverse mentorship, and I'm sure you go through this more directly in the book, which is, again, the network nonprofit, and people should definitely, you can get it on Amazon and take a look at it because I would imagine Beth's such a great writer with Allison Fine on this one. Every nonprofit should have it, and everybody that loves nonprofit should have it. But, you know, just from that perspective, the tools perspective, because that's, as you've said, strategy is strategy and tools are tools, but I think people get really caught up in the tools and what they should know. So is there any kind of rule of thumb for you in terms of the order or what's most helpful in terms of the approach to tools for organizations?
You know, that's really interesting that you asked that, because I just started a project called eMediat, where I'm working with International Institute of Education in the Middle East, with funded by the Department of State Office of Middle Eastern Partnerships. And so it's a train the trainers project in five different countries in the Middle East: Yemen, Jordan, Lebanon, Morocco. We actually just added Tunisia. So I'll be training and working with master trainers in each country. They're a team, so there'll be a master trainer, someone who's worked with NGOs, and a social media advisor. And we will be training them, and we've developed a curriculum then that they'll be delivering in their country over the course of 6 months, and then they'll be training other trainers who will also be delivering this. So in total, they'll probably train about 250 NGOs. So one of the things I've been sort of thinking about lately is just that question. And so it came down to me thinking about it kind of relates back to the Martin Luther King quote.
Yeah.
And thinking about the maturity levels of the NGOs and then what they need to do to get to the next step. So at the very beginning, we might have organizations that are not engaging at all, less so in the U.S., more so in other places of the world, just because of bandwidth. And then the next step is kind of doing things on an ad hoc basis where, it's a person of passion. Running the organization, they have a clear sense of what they're doing, but they don't always have the resources. Then the next level up is kind of knowing, having a more sense of what their objective is, who the audience is, what it is they want to talk about or communicate. And then in there, it's looking at, what's the most appropriate channel to go to to reach the audience they want to reach. And my approach has been in working with NGOs, both large and small, because whether they're, really resistant to change or whether they're just capacity challenged, is to take one channel at a time and really do it in depth as a best practice, where it's, for example, on Facebook, setting up a Facebook page that relates to a strategic goal. It's there on Facebook because they want to reach a particular audience, coming up with a content strategy, an engagement strategy, and a way to measure their effectiveness. So they have that one channel going with best practices, and that they're learning from it, they're improving it, and they got it down so it's not this foreign thing. And that might happen over a couple months, maybe it's 6 months, maybe it's 2 months, and then they can add something else if appropriate. So I believe in this kind of incremental approach and just keeping it really simple. Like, what happens a lot is I see a lot of organizations trying to do everything. That doesn't work.
It's that way in both worlds, because I know, I think this is a good lesson to broaden it out to most organizations, because even when I'm working for for-profit organizations, I talk about using a phased approach, and it sounds really similar where it's, again, that hub and spoke model. If your hub, like if you want to start blogging, if you don't have an editorial calendar, or you're being thoughtful and being timely, and if back to school is part of, if you're retail, that's part of what you do, or if you're B2B, if you're not looking at sort of quarters, and you don't add that to the calendar as reminders to say something or to address that, then you're probably not mastering, and you certainly aren't to the best practice stage. So moving on to Facebook or feeding a blog in that isn't really up to par into a Facebook page isn't the best thing to do. You need to really, like you said, master the one thing that you're addressing. And it kind of makes it easier, too, because, you are making sure you can be really confident in that one tool that you're using it correctly.
Right, and a lot of the, for all the tools, you're going to have the same sets of things that you're going to go through. You're going to have an objective, you're going to have audience, you're going to have content, you're going to have an engagement strategy, you're going to have to figure out how you're going to add this to your workflow and make it efficient, and you're going to have to figure out how to measure it and learn from your measurement to improve what you're doing. And you need to do, you know, that learning from measurement to improve engagement, to improve the content strategy, and then reiterate the next month, you know, so that you've reached a point where you're it's kind of this sophisticated learning, if you will. And once you have that down for like one tool or channel, then you can start to incorporate others or move to others depending on, you know, on context.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes I also tell people, you can just say no.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
that's such a good
all.
Point. People do feel this pressure, I know, you know, to be, you know, we have to be on Facebook, but if you don't have a good, if it's not part of a strategy or some sort of organized rollout so that you are doing best practice, I think that's such a good point. And especially, you know, a lot of the nonprofit world is run by women, and I think, you know, we're such people pleasers by nature. And I sometimes wonder if, I don't know if, you know, you obviously are working with nonprofits at a completely different level than I am or interacting with them. You know, I don't know if you see that too, where it's just this, you know, I don't know if it's just the nature of the nonprofit world where you're helping people all the time. So your thought is, oh, I need to be helpful. Or that the thought is, you know, that, you know, there's a lot of women and it's people pleasing, but whatever it is, it's okay to say no, because you're not necessarily saying no forever. You're just saying no for right now.
Yeah, I mean, it relates to one of the topics in the book. You know, I didn't explain this, but in the framework we have the being and the doing. And the being part is all the mind shift changes. And that's, you know, understanding networks, listening, engaging, relationship building, transparency, social culture. But the and then the doing stuff is all the fun stuff, the crowdsourcing, the pinging,
yeah,
the helping, the friending. But in the being list, there is simplicity. And this gets at, you know, many nonprofits feel like they have to have a soup-to-nuts monopoly on all the programs, you know. And the value of working and engaging on social networks is that it allows for abundance, a shift from the scarcity thinking that I have to do everything to opening up and really owning the outcomes, not the whole to-do list, as my friend Marnie Webb likes to say from TechSoup Global. So what that does is it allows us to stop doing so much and really focusing on the things that we do well and then networking the rest. Marnie, we had this whole long blog conversation about this called Abundance. And when an organization moves to abundance, they're moving more into this curator role, where they're not, they may be implementing all of the programs, but they're doing it. They're finding people out there, like I talk about free agents in the book, and others who are doing, and then working with them to provide a platform to make it happen. You know, one example is Charity Water.
That's a good example.
Because, you know, they do marketing and fundraising on social networks really, really well, but they don't dig all the wells. They have partners that do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they are working in a networked way, in a very creative networked way. So, you know, and that's a mind shift more than anything else, because in the nonprofit world, we're kind of been encouraged, maybe by funders or because of lack of resources. Oh, this is mine, and we're going to do it all. We're going to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah, and that can be really difficult to try to, you know, if you're an outside observer or if you're, say, you know, a contributor. And I wanted to ask this question too, because I think this can be. This can be something that maybe everyone hopefully can relate to. You know, if you're a donor, for example, and you want to be more involved, you know, like say, you know, with water.org, one of the things I love that they do, I believe, and forgive me if I've got the wrong nonprofit, but I believe it was water.org, where you can donate your tweets for a week. So they'll just drop in tweets for a week or a month about different activities that they're doing. So you can donate a certain amount of your tweets to them, which for, you know, for me is sort of, you know, a no-brainer, you know, because especially if there's a particular need going on in a particular part of the world or a campaign, I really think is a great idea. But, you know, how much does the donor role play as part of the, you know, the whole experience of where you should be and how you should be communicating, especially as donors get younger, and organizations like, you know, you had mentioned Cisco before, are doing such a great job of, you know, I think understanding the needs of nonprofits and saying, you know, just tell me what you need, and are being a lot more efficient in terms of getting help to these organizations. You know, what kind of roles can these external people, these external organizations do, and how do you see them at this point in time sort of working with organizations and maybe moving them one direction or another?
Well, you know, one of the themes in the book is working as free agents.
Oh, yeah.
And free agents are many times they're millennials, sometimes they're older, but they're individuals who are really facile with social media, who have built up networks, social movements in the palms of their hands, and are working on an issue of cause area. And these people can be a tremendous asset to a nonprofit's cause area. One person that comes to mind that's pretty well recognized as a free agent is Mark Horvath.
Mm-hmm.
He is at Hardly Normal on Twitter, but he's a homelessness advocate.
Mm-hmm.
So what tends to happen, though, then they work outside of the normal traditional nonprofit staff roles or volunteer roles. And so what happens is, I know when they've approached nonprofits to partner with them, some nonprofits sort of like push them away. And that's because those are the nonprofits that are, function more like fortresses. In the book, we talk about how nonprofits need to that are fortresses, and by fortress, I mean they have complicated approval processes. It takes 6 months to edit a press release before it can go out. They're very complex, slow-moving, and resistant to change. And so that culture needs to change to more of one of a sponge. And a sponge, an ocean sponge that attaches itself to the ocean floor, can take in 10,000 times its weight and expel the bad stuff, so a little bit more agile. And so fortresses usually just don't want the help of free agents. Sort of like talk to the hand, the head's not listening. And but the sponges out there who recognize the importance of these individuals and, you know, are working with them. I mean, and there are certain rules. I mean, some people say, what if the free agent is a wacko? They said, well, you're going to screen them, and you're going to vet them, and you're going to develop a relationship, and you're going to help, you're going to negotiate your internal politics for them, and then you're going to come up with a project, you know, or a way to work together. And on the free agent side, and I actually have a panel on this at South by Southwest, they understand that they just can't go crashing through the gates and tell the nonprofits what to do, or that they really have to, you know, be partners and do a lot of listening first for a partnership to be effective.
Interesting. So let's talk a little bit about South by Southwest, because that's right around the corner, coming up in March. So is it the nonprofits and or the rise of free agent citizens? Is that the...
yes, it's right around the corner, and I should know my panel name.
Well, I'll find it for you while you talk about it. But tell us a little bit about what we can look for. It looks like it's nonprofits and free agents in a networked world.
Yes.
And that will be Beth's panel at South by Southwest. And tell us a little bit, you know, about what you're hoping to accomplish there. So many people that are in, you know, these are the clued up folks that don't necessarily, that maybe, you know, it's perfect to talk about free agents because they're all potential free agents there. So you have the opposite issue of, not necessarily needing to teach them, but actually getting them to hopefully use some of these tools in a proactive way. But you know, will you be selling the book, and how will this tie in with basically what's going on with your book tour?
Well, I did, you know, this has been the sort of free agent idea is one that I've done several keynotes on, you know, for the Department of State and my work there. But this, I'm bringing together a couple of well-known free agents. Mark Horvath is one of them. He'll be in the room. Sean Ahmed from Uncultured will be joining us through video connection, because I think he'll be in Bangladesh at the time. And then I also will have with me representatives from nonprofits who have worked effectively with free agents. Danielle Brigidea from the National Wildlife Federation will also be on the panel. And we'll also, and so this, the way I'm organizing the panel, I don't do panels really. This will be a full Oprah-style interaction, full room interaction. So I'll have my panelists on the stage with, you know, in conversation with them, and then it'll leverage out to the audience. I plan to have my mobile microphone and walk around. And I will also have Johnny Goldstein, who will be doing graphic recording of the event, and we'll also be bringing in people through who are not in the room but through Skype video or Twitter who work as free agents. And what I hope that comes out of this are since we will most likely have more free agents than fortresses in the room,
mm-hmm.
get a better understanding of what some of the best practices are for working together. You know, what can be learned from the free agent side and your work with nonprofit, what works, what doesn't, and the nonprofits who have reached out and are working with these free agents on their side, what is it that they need to do within their organizations to navigate the politics around this, to open up their organizations, what's worked and what hasn't.
That's going to be really exciting. So now how are you going to be able to curate that if you're playing Oprah, and it, which reminds me, Oprah, if you're listening or if someone sends this to Oprah, Beth should definitely help create a show on the OWN network. Wouldn't it be great if you had a platform there to be able to get people talking? Because so much of what you've done has been about collaboration and bringing the right people together. Like you were just saying, sort of the best free agent you can think of and the best this, the best that, and really with that global perspective, I would love to see that happen. But beyond...
You're reminding me, the other person on the panel will be Jessica Dare from SMEX Beirut, who I'm going to be co-training with. She's actually coming to Austin, so she'll be talking about free agents and nonprofits from a Middle Eastern perspective, global perspective.
That's
so hopefully,
fantastic.
If we don't have too much of a time change, we'll have some people from the Middle East on Twitter joining us as well. I did this last year. I've done it before. But last year I did a session on crowdsourcing where I didn't stay on the – I had four panelists who had experienced crowdsourcing, and we did a crowdsourcing experiment, and we just brought the audience – I walked around the audience and brought people in. You know, so I
That's
had a
fantastic.
Basic conversation from the floor with the panelists, and as I was walking around, got people to join in the conversation. We had a Twitter hashtag, and I did a little bit of fun. I asked each of the panelists to prepare a Ignite-style PowerPoint deck answering five questions about crowdsourcing that we're going to discuss. But then I played. But then I took the decks and I took the best slide from each, and they didn't know which slide was going to come up, in what order. So it was a little bit of PowerPoint karaoke. So it kept them on their toes. I mean, they all knew. You know, they had all their talking points, so it would come up.
Oh, that's a great idea.
So you know, it's kind of to keep it a little improvisatory and a little bit fun. You know, I'm trying. I've been taking workshops with Heather Gold.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know her work. She teaches how to be more improvisational and how to use stand-up comedy techniques.
Yeah.
Get away from, like, dry PowerPoints.
Yeah, it's so important, too, because, like you said, you know, when you start to fire hose people with information, you have to have something to go to bring some levity, to let their brain kind of breathe. And it's you know, it can be difficult, you know, finding that balance. And, you know, it'll be, you know, interesting to see what happens. I'll have to keep in touch with you about a project that I may miss South by Southwest for, which is working with the Iraqi Elections Commission. So, you know, talk about being a free agent. I was, you know, teaching my MediaBistro.com class on Google Analytics, and pretty soon, someone from the Iraqi Elections Commission happened to have signed up, and we were both former Peace Corps volunteers. And now it looks like I'll be going to Iraq for a month to help them learn how to use analytics as a predictive technology for potential conflict, since they're in the same building as the UN and UNICEF and everyone else, to help protect areas where it looks like people are competing on the website to try to get the most hits in a particular language. and there could potentially be conflict. So, you know, it's interesting how, you know, I'm just sort of one of those bleeding hearts, but, you know, it becomes then an actual role in your life that could make a huge change, but you have to be open to it, and obviously it has to be the right time in your life and all of that kind of thing. But it can turn into something, you know, really important if, you know, if there's a need. So I think part of it is being open to those things as they come around the bend too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be really curious to find out what your impressions are of the Middle East.
We'll talk at length. Don't worry.
Yeah, I know one of the things I'm trying to be very conscious of is that, and I've worked internationally a lot. I just have never been to the Middle East, but I know that there's you have to be really careful about coming across as if you're imposing a structure or imposing a particular way of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
That was my initial, and to really honor, you know, what's there and try to change what you're doing to match what they're doing as opposed
Absolutely.
To make them change. Very, very, it's going to be really, really interesting. So, and yours
yeah,
could be
absolutely.
As well.
Yeah, well, I mean, I lived in Turkmenistan as part of the Peace Corps. So, you know, part of that was I remember my host mother, and this, you know, was a side discussion that I had with this particular student who's an adult working in Iraq. And, you know, you're completely right. When you say talking about changing the way you do things, you know, I remember my host mother coming in my first night and I was sleeping one direction and she said, oh, no, no, you need to sleep this direction because I wasn't sleeping facing Mecca. And for her, that was something that I needed to do. So learning about certain traditions and, you know, how things are done, you have to be sort of mentally very flexible. Be interesting to see, you know, that time in my life was quite a long time ago. So we'll see. Hopefully I've retained some mental flexibility in terms of, you know, being able to still take those things on board, and especially things that we're kind of used to teaching in a particular way and bringing that into a different context completely and being open to presenting it, hopefully the same information, the same best practices, but in a way that comes across in the way that it needs to for the information to be valuable.
Yeah. So it's
and I think that's, you know, getting back to your book, that's, you know, for the everyday nonprofit, you know, and we're so lucky in the Bay Area. I think, you know, it just feels like there's so many nonprofits here, but, you know, all over, you know, if you look at the United States alone, there's so many. And one of the things that, you know, I wanted to ask you about is, you know, in terms of, I mean, people must be coming to you all the time with requests for specific advice or help. And you're always so lovely and so available to people. And I'm wondering how you balance that availability with the work that you do. Is you know, what do you find, you know, how do you find a way to balance those two things?
I'm working on that right now. I need to work on it a lot better. I actually started a series of posts kind of in the new year, kind of how do you balance solitude with connectedness, which I think which is what your question is really about. So we can be so connected. We have so many friends, so many input, so much, you know, you know, I could go, you know, so many things to discover on Twitter, so many resources that that we have to understand is that really, you know, how does that prevent us from being effective? And how does that what is the impact on our ability to concentrate and to think, and what is our ability to put structures in place?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's happening to me because I'm older. My mind's going, I don't know. But I spend a lot of time online, and this year my goal is to kind of relearn solitude in a way and to get more reflection time in. And I'm doing that personally now through two ways. It's going to sound sort of new agey, but I am a big visual thinker, a visual learner,
uh-huh.
and so I've gone back to my drawings and diagramming and incorporating visual facilitation techniques now into my practice. And I'm also keeping a reflection journal. It's the idea of researching your own practice and really becoming aware and noticing when you're spending too much time online, when you're not being productive, when you're feeling overwhelmed, and when to put some limits to it. With that said, one of the reasons people do ask me for a lot, and I'm not complaining about it at all. I do get asked a lot of questions, and I encourage people to post those on the Zoetica forum so they can have the benefit of the whole community to answer it. So
mm-hmm.
I've been doing that. And a lot of people, and I, you know, I participate a lot in comments on my blog. That's where a lot of questions come as well.
Yeah, and you find a way to write, it seems like, all of the time. And, you know, you have a co-author of the network nonprofit, which is Allison Fine. And I'm curious to find out how you two connected and how that came about.
Well, we've known each other in the field for a while, and we've worked on several evaluation projects together for the Case Foundation, the America's Giving Challenge. The first
mm-hmm.
year and the second year, we wrote the evaluations. So so the way we got started was I thought I was going to write a book about free agent fundraising and write a manifesto. It was all going to be on this phenomena of free agents and fundraising on social networks for causes. And
yeah.
But I didn't. And when I was looking for a co-author, Allison and I just got along so well, and we had complementary strengths and weaknesses. And one thing we had in common was we both like to eat a lot of chocolate. But I am really good at uncovering stories and uncovering resources, and I could knock out first drafts. And I had, you know, my blog was 6 or 7 years worth of research on the evolution of the field. And Allison has a big picture perspective, a systems look. She comes from the philanthropy side, and also she told me she could spend an entire day coming up with one sentence, perfecting one sentence. And me, I write 10. I'm a long con. I've written 25 blog posts. So we.
It's true.
So
you are just
so we
a prolific writer.
Combination.
That's great. So you were able to make that work really well. So what was the sort of the first step? Was you saying, I need to find someone who, you know, can balance me in particular ways? Or were you just thinking that you would work well together first and found out about these ways of working together that worked really well later?
Yeah, probably the second way, more so, because we had worked together and she had written a book before. I also wanted someone. I've written book chapters. I've contributed like 4 or 5 chapters, but I hadn't written my own book. And I've done a collaboration and an end book, not... you know, but not a whole book. And I wanted somebody with that experience, you know, the whole publishing process. And somebody also, because Allison's really good at putting limits on. And saying,
oh, yeah.
I need that story. And I'm like saying, but here's 5 more stories on this. This is the latest one. We've got to put this one in. And she said, you know, there's going to be a time when we have to deliver the book. And you're going to have to
stop. And they're going to cut it anyway.
Right, exactly. So, And we had these great what we called them we rolled out a chapter a week or 2 weeks every 2 weeks, and so we'd start with a conversation about the topic, and so we would go on the 10.5 floor. You know, did you ever see the movie Being John Malkovich?
Yes.
Yeah,
I love
the
that.
10.5 floor. So
yeah.
So we go on the 10.5 floor. We had these windy conversations, and then. Knock out a first draft, and then play tennis back and forth.
Excellent. So you got right into a rhythm, it sounds like.
Yeah. And then it came down to, at the end, it came down to this thing where we had to consolidate our styles, and I'm more like, my tone is and style is more helpful guide on the side, and Allison was more snarky, and so we actually had to hire a snark arbitrator. You know, because we got down to some things like I would say, yeah, I really wouldn't say it this way because I think that's kind of snarky. And she said, well, yeah, but the way you're saying it is so boring. You're being
oh,
too
my
right.
goodness.
You should change it. And so we have these, like, kind of repartee like that. And then it came down to, like, there were maybe 10 sentences. And so we had our copy editor who was going through and fixing some of the punctuation and pointing out where there were incomplete sentences. and other lapses of grammar also had her decide whether something was snarky or not.
I love that because it is so important to have that balance of sort of the helpful, you know, the helpful, you know, sort of, you know, kind of like, well, we're here to help you, we're here to embrace you kind of feeling, but you also have to have some sort of ground in reality, too, so it doesn't sound like you're kind of up in fairyland with, you know, this idealistic, I sometimes think if I tell people that, you know, some of the things that I've done in the nonprofit world or volunteering my time or things that I do, people think I'm, you know, kind of in fairyland or I'm being the ultimate Californian. And I, you know, went to grad school on the East Coast and, you know, and I know kind of how that California perception comes across. Do you feel like, you know, being in California has already started to influence the way that you kind of approach things, or have you just always been this way?
Oh, God, that's a great question. I don't know. Although I did say, I did, yes, you mean, have I incorporated some of the hippie shit?
Yeah.
I kind of like it. I was sort of that way, but not. But now here it's like, it's okay, you know?
Yes.
And being in California, I'll tell you one thing it's influenced is the food is so good here. I have to watch it.
Yeah, that's
watch
true.
It. This amazing food. You know?
Oh, I know. San Francisco, we're so lucky.
Yeah.
We are very, very lucky.
The wine, it's incredible.
It is. So now, let's see, final thoughts on the book, because we only have a few more minutes left, and we want to remind people the book is The Networked Nonprofit by Beth Kanter, who we're speaking with now, and Allison H. Fine. You can get it on Amazon. And it has a foreword by Randi Zuckerberg, who, if you don't already know, she's very, you know, those of us in this sort of bubble of social networking is sort of infamous, or, well, she's not infamous, but she's well-known for being at Facebook. And, you know, I wanted to get your thoughts, too. You know, last night at the Golden Globes, The Social Network won Best Picture. And, you know, and I thought I had really sort of this emotional tide that hit me when that moment happened. And I wondered if you had any thoughts about that, you know, if we've sort of reached a tipping point in some way, you know, basically the Facebook movie, everybody called it initially, has now won a major award that was televised in NBC last
year. Yeah, I mean, I think we've been in the last year. I think we don't, you know, you don't have to explain what Facebook is. You know,
yeah, that's true.
Quite as much. And, but, you know, so organizations and nonprofits are more open to adopting it, but the resistance sort of comes up in different ways. And that's more like, do I have time for this? You know, it's the challenge of putting it into practice.
But I'm just curious in terms of, you know, in terms of seeing something like that go mainstream, do you think it will have an effect in sort of terms of those friction forces that keep progress from occurring on certain fronts? Do you think that people, I know Facebook, I agree with you, it's kind of to the point now where most organizations are like, okay, well, they'll cede that point, that, you know, it gets enough traffic alone that it's worth an effort there. But do you think it helps any of the other tools that might be the perfect, you know, like Twitter being a real-time tool, or maybe less known tools or wikis, which a lot of people are very afraid of, which can be great for collaboration? Do you think it helps when something like a film about a social network goes mainstream like that?
You have less explaining to do.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, and there's less time spent on trying to get people to an understanding around it, as opposed to actually talking about practice. You know,
mm-hmm.
That's what the difference is.
Well, I cannot wait to read this book. I have not had a chance to read it yet, but I'm really, really looking forward to it. Any final takeaways from the book, something we didn't get to that you want to mention is actually in the book, again, The Networked Nonprofit?
I think one of my favorite chapters to write was in the learning loops, and it's about the kind of being able to learn from doing and reiterating and learning, sort of not looking at things as a failure if it doesn't work the first time. And that's, you know, kind of my parting words is that people, we're still, while we've reached more mainstream adoption of these tools, I think we're still early in using social media. You know, if you think about it, it's only been around for less than a decade. And so I really think that we need to, like, think about and how we can continuously improve our practice.
That's a really good point. So sort of how we can improve our practice, but also I think part of that is also, you know, being part of these feedback loops like these wikis and other places and trying to help make sure that you're being one of the curators of lessons learned too, right?
Right, and sharing of it, that we're not just, kind of like we're seeking information, we're making sense of it, but then we're also sharing it back out. So it's seek, sense, share.
Absolutely. That's a fantastic thought, because I think it gets left behind that, you know, if you don't share the information, then it can't be part of a case study or something else that makes it easier for the next person.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, fantastic. Thank you so much, Beth, for taking time to be on the program. Again, Beth's new book is The Networked Nonprofit, Connecting with Social Media to Drive Change. It's out now on Amazon. It's co-written by Allison Fine with a foreword by Randy Zuckerberg. And I thank you so much, Beth, for being on the program again.
Great. Thank you so much, Jennifer. Hope to catch up with you face-to-face at some point.
We will. We will. And I will definitely talk to you about my trip before I go anywhere, for sure.
That's great.
I'll let you get on with your day. Thank you so much to Beth. Thank you so much to the audience for listening and contributing questions to the A-List. We're here every Monday, generally at noon, but check your listings on Blog Talk Radio or on iTunes for our latest schedule. We've got someone queued up for you next week, so get your questions in, and we appreciate you marking us as a favorite, friending us on Facebook or following us here on Blog Talk Radio, and rating us, of course, on iTunes. So we look forward to you being part of the program. This show will, of course, be archived, and you're welcome to distribute it on your blog or any other place that you feel someone can get some benefit from it. And we look forward to seeing more questions and feedback come from you from this program. And again, in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and his our holiday today, thank you again for listening. And check out Beth's book. Take care.
Great. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Sure.